On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I'm Ruth Levine, your moderator for this evening. And it's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished speaker. Don Steinberg is the president and CEO of World Learning, a nonprofit organization that provides education, exchange, and development programs around the world. He's previously served as deputy administrator at USAID, where I got to know, admire, and become friends with Don. He has also been the director of the State Department's Joint Policy Council, White House Deputy Press Secretary, National Security Council Senior Director for African Affairs, I'm not done, Special Haiti Coordinator, U.S. Ambassador to Angola, and the President's Special Representative for Humanitarian Demining. He was also Deputy President for Policy at the International Crisis Group, a Randolph Jennings Senior Fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and has advised the Women's Refugee Commission, the U.N. Development Fund for Women, the U.N. Civil Society Advisory Group for Women, Peace, and Security, and the Institute for Inclusive Security. That is a gold-plated resume. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Don Steinberg for a conversation about the role of new technologies in global development and education.
Great, thank you.
So, Don, welcome to San Francisco.
Thank you.
You have, as I just got through reading, been engaged in the world of development and particularly development assistance for a long time, maybe more than 40 years. How have you seen that change over time, and where do you see it going now?
First of all, I have to say I'm a little intimidated. You walk into the green room over there, and you see pictures on the wall of people who have come before me, and you've got Desmond Tutu and Muhammad Yunus and Queen Rania, Nick Kristof, and I'm in a little bit of an Admiral Stockdale moment. Who am I and why am I here? But I have been involved in this arena for about 40 years, and I have seen the world of development shift as dramatically as any other world you could imagine. I think 40 years ago, we had a certain perception of what development meant that has fundamentally changed. Today, I think we are, first, more confident than we used to be of our capacity to encourage development. Secondly, I think we are more inclusive. And finally, I hope we're more humble. On the area of confidence, while we haven't really reflected this well enough in our academic or our public affairs side, we've actually helped move, as a global community, 800 million people across the poverty line within the last 20 years. That's the largest group of people who have come into the so-called middle class around the world in the history of the planet. Infant mortality and child mortality rates have gone down by two-thirds in that same period. We have more kids in school than ever before. It's still a tremendously discouraging figure. We have 7 million children who die each year from preventable disease. But when I started, it was 15 million. You know, even in a situation like Afghanistan over the last decade, we've seen life expectancy go up from 47 years to almost 70 years in the space of a decade, 23 years expansion in their life expectancy. And so I think in a certain sense, we have confidence that we can continue this process. And that's what led the president in his State of the Union address last year to say that we will work with our allies around the world to eliminate extreme poverty within 20 years. And I'm delighted that Google has actually set some money aside to create a museum to poverty in 2035, because the hope would be that's the only place you can see poverty is in a museum. Secondly, I think we have redefined development in an inclusive way. When I came into the field, development, if you ask someone, what does development mean? The answer was 6 or 8 or 10% per capita growth rates over the course of a decade. That was it. You know, if you get 7% growth for a decade, you double per capita income probably, and you're developed. I think today we understand that that's not true. Right now, development has, and the growth in per capita income has to be reflected in positive ways. You know, you look at in Egypt, they've had 20 years of high growth rates, but that's resulted in income that was badly distributed, income that was subject to corruption, income that did not create educational and housing and healthcare opportunities, and it didn't create jobs. And so it didn't empower people in that environment. I think we're inclusive in a different way as well, which is to say we now understand that development relies upon bringing previously marginalized groups into the discussion. And so it's about empowering women and the LGBT community and people with disabilities. It's about bringing ethnic and religious minorities into the process to draw in indigenous populations. And when I first started talking about this, I had a question from an audience that said, why are you focused on those groups? They're so hard to help develop. And I reminded them that those groups I just described make up 75% of the population in these countries. And unless you're using their skills and their talents and not just treating them as beneficiaries of programs, you're wasting a tremendous resource. But finally, I think we're more humble today than we ever were before. You know, again, when I came into this field, we all had the answer. Agriculture was a backwater. Service industries had no economies of scale. Get everyone into manufacturing. And the phrase that we all use was import substitution industrialization. So all you had to do was take those imports that you're buying from abroad, produce them domestically through manufacturing, and everything was going to take care of itself. And then we said, well, you know, there's no infrastructure to support that. So infrastructure became the thing. And it was all about building ports and roads and bridges and schools and hospitals. And then we said, well, but it doesn't seem to be having the impact on people. And so all of a sudden, it was all about health and education and capacity building. Then we moved into, well, you know, it's really about science and technology. You know, improve seeds and better fertilizers and wonder drugs. Then for a while we moved into the area of it's all about, you know, the private sector. All you got to do is get investment flowing in and you'll create jobs and growth. Then we moved back to agriculture and then we said, oops, we made a mistake. You know, most of the people actually live in the rural areas. We got to develop. Today, we accept the fact that we don't really know. Today, we accept the fact that it's probably a little bit of all of that, and that what you do is not in a dogmatic way adopt a certain principle coming out of the World Bank or the US government or the IMF, but you try things. And perhaps most importantly, you try things using the local population and expertise that they bring, the ground truth. I think we in the US government often believed that we had the answer, that we were the big supplier of development assistance, that we were driving it all. Well, today, the US government provides about $30 billion worth of development assistance to developing countries each year. And yes, that is still under 1% of the federal budget. It's actually funny when you talk to people, they say, you know, we think that 25% of the federal budget goes to development assistance. And you say, well, you think that's too much? They say, yes, we want it to be 5%. And I always say, yeah, I'll take that 5% tomorrow. So we provide $30 billion as a government. You provide $40 billion. through private giving, through NGOs, through churches, through other institutions. Remittances going to developing countries from American residents are $100 billion. The private sector, $1 trillion. And domestic resource mobilization in those countries itself is $8 trillion. And so the notion that the solutions are made in America or made in our government are just crazy. You know, I left AID about a year ago, and I got a plaque with all of the platitudes that I had used throughout the 1,000 days that I had been there, and they were shocking. But the number one item that I said constantly there is a phrase that I love to use, and it's nothing about them without them.
Well, that is a sweeping kind of panorama of the transitions in the development world, and I think you captured really important moments. So let's sort of bring it down to your own personal experience. Mm-hmm. You know, as you've been working in development, what's brought you to the place you are now, maybe really focused on local solutions and the power of people's creativity?
Well, for me, it really all started my very first assignment. I was 22 years old. I had just gotten my master's degree in economics. I had joined the State Department. So I was a Foreign Service officer and asked to be sent out to the Central African Republic. So I arrive in the Central African Republic. I walk in and I meet the ambassador and I say, "I'm your new diplomat." And he looks at me, and my hair is really long, and I have flowered shirts. This was in the mid-70s. And he says, "You know, we really don't need any more diplomats here. What we really need is someone to run our development program. We've just been given $2 million a year for the next 4 years to try to improve the health conditions in this one province called Guam. And we can't figure out how to do it. We've tried in the past, and it hasn't worked. So that's your assignment for the next 2 years." So I decided, quite logically, that I would travel out to Guam. And let me guarantee you, it is out there. You know, if Guam isn't at the ends of the earth, you can at least see the ends of the earth from there. And the ambassador had told me I was supposed to talk to the governor and the head of the police force and figure out what they thought we could do to improve health conditions there. So I did, and I went in and talked to them. And I said, "I've got $2 million, and I want to help you improve your health conditions." Big mistake. They said, "Well, you know, we really don't have problems with health here. Our real problem is we don't have air-conditioned offices for the governor and the police commissioner, and that's what you should do. Build us air-conditioned offices for that $2 million. And I figured that probably wasn't the best approach, and so I went and talked to my Peace Corps volunteer friends who took me out to the marketplace. And we sat under the veritable baobab trees with the women traders in the market. And they knew what the problem was. They said, "Look, everyone in our community has malaria. Our children are stunted. 45% of our children are growth stunted. We have infant and child and maternal mortality rates of up to 40%. We have schistosomiasis everywhere." And I said, so what's the answer?" And they said, "Look, we know you're not going to build us a big fancy hospital, and we don't even think we need that. What we need is clean water. What we need is village health huts that have basic medicines. What we need is your help in training midwives here. We need your help in very basic medicines against malaria. And we need you guys to drain the marshes that the mosquitoes are at. And most of all, we need you to train us, because we know you're going to be leaving pretty soon, and we want you to leave something that's sustainable here." And that's exactly what we did. So we brought out Peace Corps volunteers to train people how to drill boreholes to get clean water. We trained midwives and birth attendants. We brought in anti-hemorrhaging drugs for mothers giving birth. We drained the marshes, et cetera, et cetera. Within 2 years, when I left, you could already see a noticeable decline in infant mortality, in child stunting, and maternal mortality. And I'll tell you, I was hooked. I was hooked on, first of all, the role of women in development. I was hooked on the fact that you can actually achieve a result. And frankly, I was hooked on the importance of drawing on local expertise and knowledge. And let me stress to you, none of what we were doing relevant to the discussion we're having involved very high-tech techniques. These were basic techniques that these individuals knew would help their societies.
So now flash forward to today. There's mobile phones everywhere. There are point-of-service diagnostics. There are better crops, better technologies across many different sectors. So what do you see as the role in the sort of combination of local definition of needs and ability to respond and technological innovation?
So let me flash forward not to today, but to maybe 20 years after the period that I just described. And I had just been Bill Clinton's advisor for Africa. I helped negotiate a peace agreement in Angola that ended, that sought to end at least, the civil war that had cost 500,000 lives in 25 years. And then the president asked me to go out as ambassador to Angola to implement the process. And we had a whole set of principles that we were going to use in order to do that. And I get out there and I realize that the whole thing is going to fall apart because there are 1 million landmines planted throughout the country. 13 separate armies or other, you know, the ANC planted landmines in Angola. SWAPO. To be honest with you, American oil companies planted landmines around their facilities. There were 13 separate groups that had done this. And it destroyed every attempt that we had to reestablish a sense of security, a sense of economic growth. We had 4 million displaced people who we wanted to get back to their homes. We sent some of them back. They blew up their legs going out, collecting firewood, getting water, tilling the fields. And so we went back to the US government and said, give us some money, because this whole process is going to fall apart if we cannot demine this country. And we got significant amounts of resources, but clearly not enough to take care of an entire country. And Angola is the size of Texas. So the first question came, so where are the landmines? And we went and we asked all the people who had planted them, and they wouldn't tell us. We think they had maps, but they wouldn't share them with us. And so we were at the point where we were going to say, it's not possible. And then we talked to some Angolans who said, that's ridiculous. Every community knows where the landmines are. You know, you go into a community, they know you don't go over there because that's where you need to plant the landmine, and you don't go to that water supply, et cetera. So we did crowdsourcing. This is 20 years ago before, and let me tell you, crowdsourcing has been around for centuries. The Oxford English Dictionary was crowdsourced. The people who put it together in the mid-19th century said, everyone, send us words and send us definitions and uses. Over 70 years, they had 6 million people send in information. That's crowdsourcing. So it's not like this is some new technique. So in Angola, what we did is we crowdsourced. And we went out and we said, okay, so where are the landmines? And they told us. And then we realized that we didn't even have enough resources for that. So we said, okay, so tell us where the water supplies are. Tell us where the population centers are. tell us where the transport centers are, tell us where the best fields are, and we mapped it. And we did it, you know, through computers, but the principle was we created transparencies. And you put all these different transparencies on top of each other and look down, and that tells you where you demine. And that principle helped us to remove the worst of the landmines, and the truth was that the process moved ahead fairly rapidly after that.
So are there other instances that you've observed or been part of where technology has sort of advanced the work that you were doing?
I guess the one that I like to talk about most in that regard, it comes from the last couple of years, and that's related to malaria. Malaria has been around forever. It is rampant. We thought we had solved it with DDT and a variety of other, you know, pesticides. We sure haven't solved that problem. We thought we were going to solve it through bed nets, and you know, we're trying a lot of techniques. But I was talking with some of our technicians at AID and some people in the private sector, and talking about the challenge of malaria. And malaria, the scariest moment about malaria is when you think you have it, and the time when the test comes back saying you've had it. I've had it eight times. And it takes about 3 days for the test to come back in normal situations, which is, you know, you don't want to take the curative dose because it's actually toxic. But yet, if you don't diagnose it within 24 hours, I've had cerebral malaria once, and you'll die within 24 hours. And so I mentioned this, and everyone in the audience said to me, well, don't they have cell phones and smartphones? And I said, well, yeah, you know, there are 6.5 billion cell phones in the world right now. Every village has one. A lot. And I said, so what? And they looked at me as if I was from like the 14th century, and they said, we'll get back to you. So what they did, and this involved the academic community as much as anything else, is they went out and figured out a way to address the problem and came and showed me their result. And what it is a very simple technique where you take a cell phone, you put it in one side, you put a blood sample on the other, you press a few buttons, it takes a picture, it sends it off to a database where it compares the picture. Not a single individual is involved in this. It compares the picture against other forms electronically. And within 5 minutes, it will tell you with 97% certainty if you have malaria or not. Do you know how many lives we're going to save around the world if we can create a situation where this actually is available throughout the world? It's too expensive right now. It doesn't work. And the people who developed this said, you take it. You go off to UCLA and work with the biophotometrics people. You work with the engineers there. You figure out a way to get it down to a acceptable cost. And, you know, you save the world. You know, we have one other story I like to think about, and that is kids, or actually college and grad students at University of Denver, who have decided that they really care about human trafficking. And what they've figured out is a way to take a smartphone and turn it into a social responsibility assessor. So what they've done now is working with 7 colleges all around the country on a volunteer basis, they have gone in and assessed how much trafficked labor is involved in producing key products on the marketplace. And they have put that into the machine. And so it's still got some problems with it, but really what you can do now is to walk into Walmart or Target or whatever, take your cell phone, put it up against a barcode, and it will tell you to the number how much traffic labor was involved in producing that product.
Wow.
It's still got problems because, you've got to get that data exactly right because there are lawsuits just waiting to happen in this space. But when they get it up to speed, you go in and you say, am I going to buy that shoe or that shoe? And this one costs a dollar more, but oh my God, this one involves traffic labor, that one doesn't. I'm going with that. If it works the way we hope it will, we're going to apply it to conflict minerals. We're going to apply it to child labor. We're going to apply it to tropical deforestation. And you will have, in effect, a social responsibility tool in your pocket that will change the world.
Wow, that's a great example. So we've been talking for almost half an hour, and you haven't said a word about World Learning, the organization that you are the head of. So I'm going to give you the chance to sort of say a few words about where you see the kind of horizon issues, the frontier issues, and the strength of the organization while I actually sort through some of the many questions that are coming in.
Well, World Learning is an organization we've been around for some 80 years now. We began as the Experiment in International Living, which is now a high school program where high school kids travel to mostly developing countries during the summer. And they do homestays, they do community service, they study a particular issue, whether that's environmental or human rights issues, et cetera. They learn languages. We've had about 70,000 participants in that program throughout its history. We also do another academic program where 2,000 American undergraduates go overseas to do junior year or semesters abroad. We have a graduate institute where a lot of the issues that we're talking about here are being developed. We have a master's program in Washington and in Brattleboro in development. And so we're trying to stay ahead of the curve. We also teach peace building and conflict transformation, NGO management. And then on the other side, we actually do about 70 international projects in the area of development and mostly capacity building. So right now we are working with IRC, the International Rescue Committee, to train 90,000 teachers in Pakistan to create an education system that is quality, that can compete with the madrasas, that's open to girls. And it's actually interesting because my board was a little reluctant to go into Pakistan. It's a very difficult place to operate. And so I bought each and every member of my board the book, I Am Malala, which is about the young girl, the activist for girls' education who got shot there, sent them each a copy, and I said, if you don't believe that we need to be in Pakistan after this, after reading this, you know, vote against me. And it was 23-0. So we're also doing similar work in Egypt. We're doing STEM education for girls in Egypt. We're training civil society organizations in Lebanon, in Sudan, in Burma. We just won a grant to reform the higher education system in Kosovo. And in addition to all of that, we bring to the United States each year about 2,000 international visitors to go around the United States and look and see how we're doing it, to educate Americans as to how things are being done in their countries. And so, you know, this is everything from a group of disability, I'm just thinking of the ones we've done in the last couple of weeks, disability rights advocates from Macedonia, school teachers in innovative programs from Pakistan and India who came together That was a lot of fun. Climate change experts from Iran, you know, all sorts of things to encourage international cooperation and understanding. Did you get through the questions?
I did. Well, okay. I was mostly listening to you as well. So we've got a smart crew here with lots of good questions. We've got about a half hour, I think, to tackle them. So I have to keep the pace going. So I'm going to start with one that comes right out of the recent news. So it seems that Central American children have learned the dangerous journey to Texas is better than staying home. What needs to be done to change this experience?
That's an easy question, and it really is. What we need to do as a country is to recognize that we have an interest in economic development, in peace and security in Central America. And I'm not certain what's going to happen to the $4 billion request that the president made, but I will tell you, if we had $4 billion to spend on economic development and transformation of conflict and domestic violence in Central America, we'd solve that problem overnight. We don't have anywhere near that amount of resources, and so I'm firmly convinced. Any official talking at this point has to talk about the sanctity of the border and the need to apply rule of law, et cetera. But the real answer is, let's look at the root cause of all of this.
Yeah.
I have spent a lot of time working on Guatemala in particular, and just a couple of stories that might be of interest. There is an attorney general in Guatemala whose name is Claudia Paz y Paz, who is the single most courageous woman that I've ever met. And she has been fighting for an end to impunity in that country, fighting against violence in the streets, femicide, domestic violence for years and years, and at great risk to herself. And I went down to see her, and I said, well, what can we do to help you? And she said, well, my key issue right now is domestic violence. And she said, about 3 years ago, I finally got our parliament to pass a law that said it is a crime to beat your wife. Because up until that time, it was considered a cultural practice. And she said, but the problem is that right now, they included a clause in the law that said you have to report the violence and have it come before a judge within 8 hours, or it didn't happen. And she said, I tried for a while to get it changed, and I finally gave up. And now I have an idea, which is I want to set up a 24-hour court in the capital of Guatemala so that any person can come at any time during the day and report the violence. And so we provided her some assistance. We got others to help, and it now exists. And I went down about a year ago. You walk into this place, it's a courtroom, but if you go to the right, it's a regular court. You go to the left, the first person you see is a doctor who will treat you for whatever happened and take evidence. Next person you see is a lawyer who's going to talk to you about what your possibilities are. Next person you see, if you want to, is a judge, where you actually enter the plea. Then you talk to a psychosocial counselor who walks you through and gets you back on the road to recovery. And then you talk to a counselor who's got resources and who will say, I'll go with you back to your house and we'll get your kids and we'll leave, or I'll go with you and if you decide you want to go back and be in that environment again, we'll pay for a trip to your village outside the city, will pay for a hotel room. The difference between when women would walk in the door at the beginning And when they walked out the door in the back, it was night and day. Their lives were about to be put back together. And then Claudia took me to a small village called Nabaj, where she's been working with local groups and indigenous populations to fight domestic violence. And I sat at a lunch with a group of women who have been courageous in this field. They have lobbied their local senior officials, they have lobbied business communities, they are a support group for each other. And, you know, these are mostly illiterate women who are, you know, putting forward their rights. And then one man stood up, and I will always remember this. He said, you know, I want to tell you my story here. I grew up as in a traditional Guatemalan family, and I would come home and I would watch my dad beat my mother. And it was almost like clockwork. He'd get his paycheck on Friday, he'd go out and drink, and he'd come home and he'd beat my mom. And I was a young kid, I was powerless to do anything about it. He said, when I grew up, in order to prove that I was a man, I started beating my wife. And I did this for many, many years. And then I joined this group, and I saw the impact of what I was going to be doing on women like my wife here. And I started to change. And he said, about 6 months ago, my wife gave birth to a baby boy. He said, I held that boy in my arms, and I looked down, and I said, enough is enough. This pattern stops with me. And he said he would never engage in domestic violence again. So if we can afford $4 billion to affect that kind of change in Central America, I think we'll solve that problem.
Thanks. Have you had any experiences of communities being resistant to outside aid or assistance? And how do you overcome this challenge? How do you engage in a fully respectful way?
I think it relates to what I was just saying what I was saying originally in terms of listening and coming up with local solutions and respecting cultures. Now, that doesn't mean you respect wife beating. That doesn't mean you respect other cultural practices that are violations of international, you know, human rights law. But it does mean that you go about it in as respectful a way as you can, and you recognize, for example, that in, you know, take Afghanistan. Yeah, you can find a lot of resistance to the kinds of changes that Western aid agencies were trying to bring there. But it was largely because it was dealing with government officials who had their own priorities, and we listened to them. We too closely identified what we were doing. God, there are a lot of questions.
See, you gotta keep the answer short.
Okay, with security concerns. So basically, it's just a question of listening to populations and to decide who matters in that society. It's not always the government official. It's not always the police commissioner. It can be the women in the marketplace.
Okay, I'm going to bring, by popular demand, I'm bringing the conversation to a few technology-related questions.
Great.
One is, how do you take technology like the malaria test or the solar suitcase to scale? And I'm going to add to that.
Mm-hmm.
If a software engineer wants to help, where can that person find out about projects that need help and that will have an impact?
The scale problem is the single toughest problem we face because we have been able to come up with some of the most amazing technology that is too expensive. And I think it's really a question of time. It's a question of people linking up with engineering associates. I think we've finally accepted the fact that development is not just a social science. I was thinking about this the other day. When I went to graduate school in development, the idea that I would ever go over to the engineering lab was just completely anathema. Today, that's where it's happening. You know, you go over to Berkeley and the Blum Center, which is doing some of the most exciting and innovative work in this space. You go down to Stanford, where they're working on biomedical devices, UCLA, et cetera. And so the answer to the second question is there are institutions out there in the academic environment who are doing it. But I think what we've seen now is the democratization of development. It's not just coming from academic environments. It's not just coming from government, you know, DARPA or other institutions. It's coming from people in their, you know, their garages. And people who are sitting playing on computers. There's this great story about one of the techniques that was adopted to do diagnostics in polio in particular. And apparently what happened was an individual went and spoke at a university, and it's supposed to be MIT, but I'm not sure it is, and said, you know, here's the problem that we're facing. And the students in the audience, when he left, made a pact that they would not play a computer game until they had solved that problem. And it took them 6 weeks, and they came up with the diagnostic tool. And it sounds like a Seinfeld episode, but so you know, this is all democratized now. You come up with a great idea, you go to a entrepreneur, you go to a university, et cetera. So the short answer here is the Blum Center at Berkeley is a great place that is looking into all of these types of technologies. The Stanford biometrics place is also out front in this space. But I would also say that USAID, and I'm no longer there, so I can say this without fear of people saying I'm rooting for the home team, has put together a consortium of universities around the country that are developing these techniques. And so there is a center, the Blum Center here, that is looking at new technologies and doing sort of a consumer reports type exercise to decide their capability. Texas A&M is looking at conflict resolution and new technologies for that. Michigan State is doing agriculture. Duke is doing health. There are also foreign universities involved in this exercise. So McCrary University in Kampala is part of this exercise. And so I would link up with that as well.
Great. You want to talk a little bit more about the rise of technological innovation within developing countries? You know, mobile money really started in Kenya, right?
Absolutely.
The efforts to increase transparency and combat corruption really, you know, have their home, many of those efforts through SMS texting to reveal who's paid a bribe, have their home in East Africa and India. Where do you see the sort of innovation in the developing world playing in, even on in the technology space?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely, you're absolutely right. And again, this is what we were talking about, the democratization of development. It's not just about MIT or Berkeley anymore. It is about, you know, developments in South Africa that are very exciting, in India, et cetera. Mobile money, as you mentioned, is to me the most exciting phenomenon around right now, because it not only is a source of developing capital accumulation, it's also potentially one of the most enabling and liberating devices for women, who can now keep money on a machine as opposed to underneath their mattresses where their husbands take it. It's a way of getting capital that's sent through remittances to be used for investment rather than just consumer expenditures. There's this great story in Afghanistan when they finally started to use cell phones to pay military personnel around the country. And all of a sudden, they had military people coming to their leaders and saying, something's going on. I'm getting 20% more now than I used to get. What's going on here? And what's going on here is that people weren't stealing 20% of the money before it got to them. So absolutely, and I would even add to that some of the most exciting technology in terms of election monitoring is coming from developing countries in India and Indonesia in particular.
Great. Looks like there are a lot of people who either are or know of aspiring development professionals in the audience. So what advice do you have about the skills needs for people who want to work in international development and some of the opportunities?
So I think the single point I would make there is you can't do development in isolation. There's no such thing as let's go out and do development. You know, I went to journalism school at Columbia, and they teach you the first day that you can't write writing. You have to write about something. So you have to know something in order to apply it. So some of the best development economists I know started out as anthropologists or sociologists or coming from the medical profession. So I think that's a key point. The other point is, just going back to the journalism example, you know, you go to Columbia Journalism School and they tell you, you know, you're going to this great Ivy League school, so you think you're going to sit around and talk about the role of, you know, a free press in modern society and democracy. Uh-uh. They send you out to Bedford-Stuyvesant, and you walk into a police station at 2:00 in the morning, and you study and you prepare to understand crime in that city. You go to Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, and you learn how to cover health situations. You go to local school boards, and you learn about that. By the time you leave Columbia, you're ready to work the next day at, you know, a small town newspaper or the New York Times or the Huffington Post, I guess today I should refer to. I would say quite proudly that that's the principle at World Learning. And if I can do a bit of a plug, in the development area, in the peace building area, in the NGO management area, the master's degrees that we provide are entirely experiential. You spend much of your time actually in the field working with an NGO or a host government, actually developing the skills you need. You research a difficult issue or process. I just read one of our master's students who came up with this innovative approach to get low-cost energy into slums in outside of Delhi. And, you know, I'm stunned at its simplicity, and it's going to work, and we're going to provide a fellowship for this individual to pursue this idea. The single answer would be, you know, put aside the ideology, put aside the principle, put aside the theory, and get the skills you need.
Great. And do you see, and you hinted at it, do you see sort of technological applications being an increasing part of World Learning's work?
Oh, absolutely. I will say we're being challenged because, frankly, the area of education has been, all about classrooms for so long that we're having to incorporate distance learning. And we're having to retrain our people to do low residency programs. and we're looking at MOOCs, and it's a challenge because you have people whose professions have been based upon a certain paradigm that is changing dramatically. I'll just tell you, for example, the experiment in international living that I described before, high school kids going overseas. Up until the last few years, we've said, don't take your cell phone with you. You're not allowed to, because we don't want you sitting in some village playing a computer game. We want you to be integrating into the society, et cetera. And over the last few years, we realized that even in that fishing village in Tanzania, everybody else has a cell phone, and you're the only one who doesn't. Right. So, you know, this notion of the noble savage out there, it just isn't true anymore. So we're having to incorporate that as well. What we are doing as an institution, and we're actually doing this in November, is drawing together all of our field staff and saying, okay, what is special about the way we do things at World Learning? And how is the technology change, or how are the technology changes that are going to occur over the next decade going to affect that? How do we stay ahead of the curve? And we're inviting in the Googles and the IBMs and the Facebooks of the world to educate us. And it's going to be an open session that we're going to have that doesn't just involve World Learning, but a variety of organizations. And we got one particular funder who has agreed to sponsor the whole thing. And so, you know, I'll answer your question in December.
Okay, we'll look forward to it. So there are lots of questions, which I think you'll be able to answer one-on-one during the reception. I just want to sort of give you one more question to perhaps close with. Mm-hmm. So you work on health and education issues around the world, but some argue there are a few problems at home. How do you respond? Should we be really focusing on
absolutely
our own problems here?
Yeah, and let me acknowledge that that's the case, that I do worry at times that if we don't communicate to the American people that we actually know how to do this, that we can actually affect change in developing countries, the answer would be, you know, let's focus the resources at home. You know, there's this old saying that in the past, foreign assistance meant that you take money from poor Americans to give to rich foreigners. I think we're beyond that at this point. I also think that it is incumbent upon all of us to remind ourselves and our compatriots that development is in our national interest. It's in our national interest because of our value structure. We prefer to live in a world that's peaceful, that's prosperous, it's democratic, that's respectful of human rights and respectful of human dignity. It matters to us because our biggest markets for exports and potential investment abroad, which creates jobs in America, are in developing countries. You know, we're not going to be dramatically expanding exports to Europe. They're pretty stagnant, Japan, et cetera. It's developing countries. 11 of our fastest 15 growing markets for exports are in developing countries, and not just developing countries, countries that currently or formerly got U.S. development assistance. But finally, there's a security reason for this, and we talked a little bit about Central America, but just a quick reminder, the countries that are peaceful and prosperous and respect women and use the full population for development, those countries don't traffic in drugs and in people and in weapons. They don't transmit pandemic diseases that can affect our people. They don't send off huge numbers of refugees across borders or across oceans. They don't harbor terrorists. They don't harbor pirates. And perhaps most importantly today, they don't require American troops on the ground. And so it is an important reminder to ourselves that we can do good by being good around the world, and we can help ourselves by promoting development all around the world. And just a reminder, if we had spent the $4 billion in Central America, think of what the advantages would be for our country.
So would you encourage young people today who are thinking about whether, who are interested in contributing to social change and who are thinking about either pursuing international work or working at home, what would you say to them?
I'd say it's the single most exciting area in the world right now. It is the equivalent.
International development.
International development. It's the equivalent of the moonshot in the 1960s. We have a chance within 20 years, and I mean this quite seriously, and I wish I weren't 61 years old. I wish I were 24. But we have a chance within 20 years to actually have a world where extreme poverty, defined as per capita income per day of $1.25, no longer exists. There will be pockets where that's the case, but we have the chance. I mean, sorry to put it in religious terms, Jesus once said, the poor will always be with us. Well, we have a chance to turn that around. And I can't think, you know, as we're all looking for purpose-driven lives, I can't think of a purpose that would be more important than that.
And Silicon Valley has a role to play?
Oh, absolutely.
Not just as a funder, but as a contributor?
As a funder, as a contributor. And let me say, I have gotten way beyond corporations as charity institutions, as social responsibility institutions. I'm never going to turn down a contribution from a business for a good cause. But what I really want is those businesses to recognize that doing development overseas is in their own interest and to put it into their business plans, and to recognize that there is far more money to be made by meeting human needs abroad than by exploiting them.
Well, I think that's a great note to conclude on. And unless you have any final words you want to say about world learning or...
One last thing I wanted to say, which is Ruth is... You know, Bean has been just the moderator at this, but she is one of the great development professionals in our industry. Ruth Levine put together a monitoring and evaluation structure for USAID that has literally changed our business. It has provided a new era of transparency, a new era of transparency, a new accountability to what we do. It is sweeping the world right now as the gold standard. I once called it the gold standard, and she hit me up later and said, it's platinum. So, I'm a huge fan, and one of these days I'd like to be the moderator for when you talk about what you've done in this space.
Well, that is very, very kind. That concludes our program for this evening. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking Don Steinberg for this excellent discussion and a tour de force of looking at 40 years of development. Many thanks to you, the audience, for terrific questions.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Thank you.